Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Richie Neal, I know that you're a historian, you're a scholar, you're a teacher. There is nothing that represents moving forward in this country more than the Civil Rights Act. Tell us about it. When did it pass, and how did it happen?
Well, there was a time, I think, when legislative skill was deemed to be an art form, and it was really honored and acknowledged by the news media, which it would be difficult, I think, today to explain the give and take and the intricacies of the success that Lyndon Johnson had in 1964. Arguably, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is one of the greatest legislative achievements of the 20th century, and it did fundamentally change America all for the better. But I think when you delve into whether it's Todd Burdum in his recent book about the selling of the act or Robert Caro's series on Johnson, you really see this magnificent art form. And many of these folks, incidentally, could be erudite. Many of these folks offered great eloquence to address the great stain on American history, which was the stain of race. And Johnson's determination, based upon Kennedy's offering, really was transformative. But I also think that what it fascinates me is Johnson's ability to make sure that Everett Dirksen, the Republican leader in the Senate, received full credit for bringing a large number of Republican senators on board, and a fellow named McCullough from Ohio, a congressman who also was very conservative in his nature, but he thought that it was time to address the issue of inequality in America. And when you have a chance to delve into the success of this initiative on its 50th birthday, you come quickly to conclude that many of the reputations of those days, including Humphrey, was cemented because he was the legislative floor leader in the Senate, and always to witness the transformation of the American South, which had been very Democratic up until that Civil Rights Act. And in fact, Barry Goldwater voted against the Civil Rights Act in 1964. And you give great credit, I think, to Lyndon Johnson, who tried in 1957 to do a Civil Rights Act, and as he became more ambitious and saw the White House as perhaps a new address for him, he certainly went out of his way to make sure that Northerners understood the efforts that he was making, and it helped his legacy, for sure.
So Johnson, the ultimate politician, you and I have mentioned this to each other before, but he knew he'd lose the South, right?
He confided that to Bill Moyers in a conversation, that he knew the South was gone for generations. But, you know, it was pretty savvy on his part that he had two sponsors when he arrived in Washington. And one was Sam Rayburn, the Speaker of the House, who was a Texan. And then Richard Russell in Georgia, who, other than race, Georgia would have been a new Russell would have been a new dealer. And he was Johnson's chief sponsor. Johnson never joined the Southern Caucus in the Senate.
And because he thought he'd be president someday?
That was because he thought he might be president someday, correct. And I think that he always had an eye for history, but he also had this magnificent ability on the inside to measure the individuals he was dealing with. The senator from Arizona, Carl Hayden, who had never voted to break a filibuster in his career because he thought that it cut against the grain of courtesy in the Senate.
Former sheriff, I believe, of Tombstone.
That's right. He was prepared to vote to break the filibuster, even though in the end Johnson didn't need him, but it was Johnson's promise of bringing water to Arizona.
Wow.
And
it was that simple. It was just
a trade. That simple, and not to miss the point that the Republican leader in the House, Charlie Halleck, was promised a NASA program at Purdue, and Johnson, savvy enough to say he couldn't have it all at once because he thought if he gave it to Halleck all at once, that Halleck might break away on succeeding amendments.
Yeah.
So it's that sort of salesmanship and sponsorship. And Johnson, time and again, suggested that we should say only good things about Everett Dirksen.
Well, you know, you make him sound like a decent human being, but there are those people who think that he really was a nasty piece of work.
Well, I mean, there is a Machiavellian sense to selling legislation and convincing people to do what they might not want to do. And I think that there is the carrot and there is the stick, and the way that he stood up to people like George Wallace and others publicly and tried to cajole them privately into enforcement of the Civil Rights Act. And in fact, even with the governor of Mississippi, Johnson pointed out to him very clearly, I know what you're saying, but you have to understand something. You need to make this work. And at least there was a quiet acceptance of what Johnson had to say. And the other part of it I think that's important to remember is because they saw themselves as friends. It was a very important consideration. And Johnson had many Republican friends as well as Democratic friends. But you're not, I think, overstating the fact that when intimidation was necessary, Johnson used intimidation.
Here you are. You're a very powerful man. You won't admit it, but you are. You know, there's much talk that if the Democrats take back the House, you're going to be the chairman of one of the most powerful committees of all. But you're a nice man. And I've known you for a while now, but does that make you less effective because you're not as nasty as some of these guys are?
No, I think that there are different roles that one has here. There's the public role that you have in terms of salesmanship, and then there's the private role that you have in terms of selling the package. And I think in terms of selling the package, what's very important is that you convince people the merit of your argument, and then you use the opportunity to provide a little bit more than is necessary to get them to vote for it. And at this, not to miss the point that there comes, I think, as Rostenkowski used to say when I went to the Ways and Means Committee, and he was the chairman, Dan used to say very simply, I told you I was with you until the end. It's the end. And I think that's a necessary reminder that you could be nice in public, but you need on the inside to be very vigorous and not to sacrifice your principles, but to understand that there are times when compromise simply makes good sense.
Rostenkowski, of course, got caught later on, and it was a terrible failure, the fall of a great man.
It was the fall of a great man, and it was something that, by the way, when I came to Congress, while I wasn't aware of it, it was apparently for that generation it was commonplace.
Sure.
And it was not unusual. But I also think back at the legacy of these individuals when it comes to perhaps one of the other extraordinary votes that was cast in the mid-60s, and that was for Medicare.
Yeah.
I mean, remember that Bob Dole voted against Medicare, and it was Rostenkowski and Tip O'Neill and people of that ilk and reputation that ensured that Medicare would pass. And I think that when you look at civil rights, voting rights, Medicare, Medicaid, and you consider the National Endowment for the Humanities and the National Endowment for the Arts, you can't miss the fact that it was Johnson's legislative skill plus an extraordinary victory in 1964 that allowed him to, in fact, implement many initiatives that the country just accepts today as being part of our fabric.
No question. I only have a couple of minutes, but you just gave me another question, and that is this. Obviously, the kinds of things that we saw with Medicare and Medicaid were controversial at the time. They got them through. The president gets through what we now are calling Obamacare by the Affordable Health Care Act. Do you see any parallels?
I do. Remember that when Roosevelt offered Social Security in 1935, it took 2 years before it was implemented. And in the case of Medicare, there was a very bumpy rollout. In the case of Medicaid, a very bumpy rollout. It took a long time for the precept of Medicare and universal coverage for people at 65 years old to take hold. The opposition to Medicare was ferocious, including the American Medical Association.
Sure.
They called it a government takeover. And today, I don't know anybody who seriously would curtail the entitlement of Medicare.
When you say entitlement, what do you mean by that?
I think it's an earned benefit.
Oh, I see. The program. Right.
The program.
Got it. Well, yes, it's a lesson that I think we ought to keep our eye on in terms of the progress here, because it does seem that there's less hullabaloo among the general population about Obamacare than there was in the beginning.
Well, you can see the changes in polling as it's been implemented. 8 million people have signed up. And let's be candid. We need to fault the White House for the technological failure that they had. But I don't think that that should be substituted for the universal success that the ACA has the potential to become if we do it the right way.
Richie Neal, it's just such a pleasure to have you back on. Always great when you're here.
Delighted to be with you.
And you're terrific.